Members, the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform will come to order. We do have a quorum, members. The first order of business is if we can move the minutes from March 8th. Do I have a motion to move the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Albright moves the minutes for March 8th. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, our first order of business today is House File 2445, Representative Albright. And members, the bills before us today have moved to the Subcommittee on Licensing and have been heard there and are now moving through our committee. So, members, we will not have public testimony today unless there are specific questions that can't be answered by the author. But with that, we will hear the bills presented and take any questions and then move on from there. So with that, Representative Albright moves House File 2445 be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill before us. I'm not aware of any amendments, Representative Albright, so with that, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2445 is a housekeeping bill that specifically targets four objectives. One, it allows more than one of the 11 physician appointees to the Board of Medical Practice to be a licensed physician holding the degree of Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine. Currently, the language allows only one osteopathic physician appointee to the board. Two, it updates the terminology throughout the Medical Practice Act to accurately represent and reference osteopathic physicians and osteopathic medicine. Three, it aligns the number of attempts allowed to pass the comprehensive osteopathic medical licensing examination complex USA with the number of attempts allowed to pass the United States Medical Licensing Examination, USMLE. And finally, it repeals references to obsolete licensing and examination requirements for osteopathic physicians that were in effect prior to May 1st, 1963. So with that, members, I am happy to answer any questions on the bill as it is amended.
Members, any questions for the author? Seeing none, I think that would be a wrap then on your bill, Representative Albright. So with that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 2445 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Members, the next bill on the agenda is House File 978, Representative Zerwas. And Representative Zerwas will move that his House File 978 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. We have the bill in front of us. I understand that there is an A2 amendment, Representative Zerwas.
That is correct, Madam Chair. I'll move the A2 author's amendment.
Okay. Members, why don't we take action on that amendment, and then you can speak to the amendment, Representative Zerwas? So Representative Zerwas moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just briefly, House File 978 is a bill for licensure of genetic counselors. At our licensure subcommittee hearing, we had some pretty compelling testimony from both some practitioners as well as a patient. Genetic counselors are healthcare providers with significant training expertise in molecular biology, medical genetics, and psychosocial counseling obtained through a minimum of 2-year master's level program. There are approximately 30 accredited graduate programs in the U.S., including the University of Minnesota right here in Minnesota. The practice of genetic counseling, genetic counselors are part of the healthcare team. They interact with patients and physicians directly and provide care directives and are part of the team that collects and interprets family medical histories, identifies individual and family risk of genetic conditions. They explain inherent and natural inheritance history. They quantify the chance for occurrence and recurrence. They review and consult with physicians on potential testing options and make recommendations. They discuss management, prevention, and research opportunities for the patients under their care, and serve as patient advocates and refer individuals and families to community or state supportive services as appropriate. And, Madam Chair, members, these individuals are often interpreting very complex medical information, including very complex histories, and coming up with a recommendation or evaluation of what is in the best interest of a patient. And whether that's a cancer patient or a family member of a cancer patient who may want to increase the occurrence of their testing, or if you're an individual who has had a case of breast cancer and may want to consider a radical double mastectomy because of the genetic markers in your body, or as I've recently had, if you're a genetic counselor that's counseling a young family who is meeting with a husband and wife who's expecting their first child, and the husband has a congenital heart defect, they're going to come and they're going to seek out your advice on what that looks like. Madam Chair and members, they're a key component of the healthcare team, and we were happy to hear their testimony and their story in our subcommittee. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerwa, since I'm not on your subcommittee, I didn't get an opportunity to hear the testimony. But I brought with me, of course, today, of course, a copy of the statute that governs licensing, Section 214. And I'm sure, as you know, the key issue under 214 is whether the unregulated practice of an occupation may harm or endanger the health, safety, and welfare of citizens of the state, and whether the potential for harm is recognizable and not remote. And then why existing civil or criminal laws or procedures are inadequate to prevent or remedy the harm. So let me first say that I think that what you've said about the practice of genetic counseling, you know, certainly is true. I mean, this is, I think it's a very important profession. I think they have a very important role to play. But our statutory scheme, first of all, they are already under some level of regulation. Are they not? Maybe you could just, first of all, explain, just tell me what is the current level of regulation of genetic counselors in Minnesota?
Representative Zerwa.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for that question. I have a testifier that's available to talk about the current level of regulation that envelops genetic counselors, as well as to answer your very important questions under Chapter 214. And I'll let my testifier introduce herself here.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself and then proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity this afternoon. My name is Joy Larson-Hidley. I'm a genetic counselor from Maple Grove that works at the Humphrey Cancer Center. And I'm also the immediate past president for the National Society of Genetic Counselors. So currently in Minnesota, there is no regulation for genetic counselors. And to your question about protecting the public, the HF 978 is extremely important to protect the public from potential harms that can result from our occupation remaining unregulated. These harms from untrained individuals attempting to provide genetic counseling can include the misinformation regarding genetic risk or lack of risk, misunderstanding of the implications of information such as family history or test results, and that can lead to unnecessary medical treatment, surgery, lack of prevention of disease or monitoring strategies, irreversible medical decisions such as the bilateral mastectomy, and avoidable fear, anxiety, and guilt. That was well highlighted in the New York Times article this past weekend by Gina Collada as being very real issues that patients do face when those results are not interpreted correctly. It impacts not only the person sitting in front of you, but their entire family when that does not happen well.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that. So since their genetic counselors are under no regulation whatsoever in Minnesota, Is there evidence that any of those kinds of harms have occurred in Minnesota or elsewhere where there's no regulation? And conversely, is there any evidence that in states where there is regulation that there's been less harm? So I can well understand that what mm-hmm. you're describing could certainly be the case. If somebody says, sure. gee, I can tell you what your risk is, right. and they give the wrong information, that indeed could cause serious harm to someone.
Sure.
But is there evidence that, in fact, that's happened?
Ms. Larson-Heidley.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. In the literature, there have been multiple cases, multiple articles that have been published documenting a collection of cases from all across the country, including an article from cases that were highlighted from here in Minnesota. Examples of that would be women who had what's called a variant of uncertain significance. That's something that could be the difference between brown eyes and blue eyes, being told that this is something that's important for your cancer risk and going on to have a bilateral mastectomy because of it, or having an oophorectomy in their childbearing years, in their early 30s, and that long-term repercussions from a surgery that was unnecessary to put her into menopause because the results were not understood.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so is this misinformation in the what you've just described, was this misinformation given by people who under this bill would no longer be allowed to give advice like that? Or is this being given by, say, a physician who's still going to be able to give advice?
Right.
Ms. Larson-Heidley.
Thank you. So with this bill isn't really a scope of practice issue because we work side by side with our physician colleagues, and so it's our job to collect that information, provide them the best summary so that they can use that information to help guide their patients' care. So we really do work in a team effort. What it does do, though, is it does help the patients and the public to identify who is appropriately trained and qualified to provide this service. Right now, it's very difficult for the public to identify that because almost anyone can hang a shingle and say that they are a genetic counselor.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But that is my question. Is there evidence that people who are unqualified are doing that? I guess that's kind of what it comes down to. And is there evidence from other states that unqualified people are calling themselves genetic counselors and that is, in fact, harming the public?
Yes.
Ms. Larson-Heidley.
Yes. Like I mentioned the articles that have been published in the literature. There's been several that were published in Genetics and Medicine talking about those people who had thought that they were seeing a genetic counselor only to learn after the fact that that person did not have the appropriate training and did not receive the appropriate interpretation of their result.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to dominate this, but could you just be a little more specific? I mean, this is kind of, members, this is the crux of the decision on all these licensing things. And frankly, on this one, I think it may be justified. But every single one of these licensing bills that we're hearing is governed by this statute. And the crux of it is whether this is necessary to protect the public, because whenever we do licensing, mm-hmm. we're fencing out somebody else. Somebody's getting licensed, and it's fencing out right. somebody else. So the real crux of it is whether there's harm to the public if we don't do this. And so could you just maybe be a little more specific? I mean, because anybody can just, sure, there's harm. And, you know, I'm not, you know, disbelieving you. I just want you to be a little more specific about it.
Ms. Larson-Heidley.
Sure. So right now, for a genetic counselor, we have board certification, which really is an academic credential that proves that I've taken the classes, I can pass the test. Without having legislation licensure in Minnesota, one of the challenges that we face is that if I have done my job badly, there is no ability for the public to have repercussion or for Minnesota to ensure that someone in the state is providing safe and appropriate care. Licensure would allow that opportunity.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
And that's kind of the other crux of this is if you have licensure and you have someone that is inappropriately or has an inability to identify and I don't know if diagnosis is the correct word, but to evaluate the complex information and test results and are not doing that, what obviously the licensure bill would allow is rather than someone that just says, I've reached the attained educational requirement and No matter if you're good, bad, or indifferent, you will always have that. I can never take away someone's education. But if we have someone that's been inappropriately determining results and providing bad guidance or bad advice based on a bad interpretation of those results, that would be something that a licensure oversight board could intervene on, where today that simply is not true. And so in the case studies that were cited out of Minnesota, where we had inappropriate test results and inappropriate treatment recommendations, there was no ability to go back and find those folks that are not fulfilling their role adequately and keeping them from doing more harm.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas. Well, you know, I guess in this case, you know, I think there's probably a better case for this than in some others, but, I mean, the statute does say that there's, first of all, it says that the proponents shall submit a written report to the chair of the committee. I don't know if that's happened, but the report is supposed to say, give any reason why existing civil or criminal laws or procedures are inadequate to prevent or remedy harm to the public. And, you know, I get it that if somebody gives bad advice, that could be indeed very, very harmful. And if they hold themselves out as knowing something and they don't know, that could be very harmful. But, you know, I don't know why in that case civil or criminal laws might not be adequate. But, you know, I mean, I don't want to keep on beating on this thing, but I did want to bring it up, especially on this first bill that we're really hearing, because I think the same principles apply to all of these bills. And so, anyway, thank you.
Oh, I'm Representative Freiberg. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I just put my hand up. So, thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a couple questions about the language here. First of all, it licenses aren't required in line 3.21. Licenses aren't required for students or interns with the amendment language who've graduated in the last 6 months or who are currently enrolled in ACGC accredited genetic counseling educational programs. ACGC is the Accreditation Council for Genetic Counseling. I'm just wondering how many ACGC accredited educational programs there are in Minnesota, and if there are any unaccredited ones in Minnesota.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, I think it's just the university. It's D of M.
Okay.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. On line 4.6, the applicant's social security number is required. I'm always wary about giving out my social security number. Is that standard practice for medical licensure, or, you know, is it really necessary to give that to a board?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, and I guess maybe Ms. Abe, I'm being told, yes, that's standard language for licensure.
Okay.
I'm with you, though. I like to hold that close.
Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah. Thank you. The last question. There's licensure by equivalency in subdivision 4, which starts on page 5.24. It says that the board may grant license, you know, it's the circumstances of, you know, somebody's been practicing for 10 years and the circumstances under which they can be licensed, common law licensure, I guess, if you could call it that. But the dates on there are all, they have to have provided the information by February 1st, 2016, and this whole subdivision online paid on line 6.5 expires on February 1st, 2016. Have people already done that, or should that date be updated? Is that an old date?
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Freiberg, you get some candy. Representative Freiberg. It was from bill language from last year when this bill was introduced. So as we move forward, that will be amendment language that will bump up a year. Obviously, it's supposed to be, it needs to be 2017.
Thank you.
And thank you, Representative Freiberg. And members, if there's no objection, we could do an oral amendment if it's a technical change to bring the dates up. Or nope, let's listen to what Ms. Aves has to say. Ms. Aves.
Madam Chair and members, those changes were made by an amendment in the licensing subcommittee to change those dates.
Oh, is that?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, we have a newly engrossed version that I don't know. I thought that would have been provided to the committee, but that was part of our updates. What's the dates?
Excuse me, members. My understanding is we do have that new engrossed version in your packet. Members have that? At the top, it should say 978-1.
Do I get?
Yeah, I have that.
Do I get your candy then?
We can all share.
Okay, so members should have that version in front of them just to make sure they're working off the latest version.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hayes.
Question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do think now that you can apparently get your DNA tested by internet or whatever, I mean, I think it's important for people to have access to reliable sources, at least in terms of doing this. My concerns were actually about the everybody who brings us a licensing bill writes it from their perspective and not necessarily from that of other professions. And I had a concern about line 2.25, in which we're in the scope of practice allowing them to discuss management of conditions with clients, and that to me is the practice of medicine. If a genetic test says I have a predisposition towards disease X or Y, the management of that condition, or I may want to check to see if it's a hereditary form of cancer or something else, but how to manage that cancer really isn't under, I don't think would be under the scope of a genetic counselor. That sounds to me more like medical care. And the same thing under the lines 3.12, the subdivision 3, other practitioners. It prohibits others from doing this unless it's in their scope of practice. And I'm not sure if we have included this in the scope of practice of, for example, neurologists or oncologists or OBGYNs or other people who routinely run into these kind of questions, and people ask, well, could this be an inherited issue or those sorts of thing. And I'm just, I don't know if you had some testimony or support from the MMA about that, but I was concerned about that management of conditions, and then also to make sure that someone's looked at whether or not we need to update the scope of others who are doing this right now, because we're prohibiting them from doing it unless it's in their specific scope.
Representative Zerwas.
And I think I'll turn it over to my testifier to talk about your specific concern with the management language in here. My understanding is it's a collaborative arrangement between the genetic counselor and the attending physician, and when we talk about disease management. But before I say something that's not correct, I'm going to turn it over.
Ms. Larson-Hidley.
Sure. So when it comes to the medical management, the genetic counselor's scope of practice allows us to review the medical management information that's provided in the literature and summarize that so that we can educate the patient on what are the complete options that might be available. But our scope of practice stops at being able to set forward any kind of plan on how to act with that. That's when we hand it over to our physician colleagues, and we provide that information to them. They set the care plan, but our job is to educate the person in front of us as to what the overall global issues are with their condition, so that when they meet with their rest of their healthcare team, they can take an active part of that conversation and know what issues might be apparent to them. But we cannot order, for example, we couldn't order mammograms or breast MRI for someone at high risk. That goes to the MD.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still concerned about the language, just because I sense that there are genetic counselors who specialize in disease A or condition B, and they may actually be familiar and up to date with what the treatment options are. But I suspect many of them may have a broader practice. And as DNA testing and other things evolve, we're going to have people who don't specialize maybe as much. And so I'm just a little concerned about why a genetic counselor should be talking to you about treatment. I think they can talk to you about your risks of having developing something. I think they can talk to you about the risks of passing it on to your children, about you know, those sorts of things. That's, to me, their skill and expertise. But keeping up on the medical literature and what the latest treatment is for any particular one condition, I'm not sure that you can assume that of all, particularly if they tend to specialize or they just tend to read, you know, the DNA test you get from the kit you mailed in. And so I'm still a little concerned about that language and would hope that since it's going to another committee that the MMA and some others would weigh in on that one.
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Loeffler, we do have several committee stops left, and as we go through that, if you want to work with me and some of the stakeholders on looking at that and trying to find out, this will come back to HHS finance, and so we'll see it in HHS again. And so as this moves forward, if we want to find some language that we're more comfortable with for that scope of practice piece around that management portion, we can certainly do that, and my advocates would be certainly open to that.
Thanks. Okay, members, I don't see anyone else with questions at this time. So with that, Representative Zerwas will renew his motion that House File 978, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Election Policy. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, members.
And members, our next bill on the calendar is Representative Zerwas' bill, House File 2344. And Representative Zerwas will move that House File 2344 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. We have the bill before us, and I understand, Representative Zerwas, you have an A3 amendment.
Correct.
So members should have that amendment in their packet. Representative Zerwas, with it being an author's amendment, why don't we take action on it, and then you can speak to the bill as amended. So members, Representative Zerwas moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Zerwas, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, members, the A3 amendment was some comfort language between the orthotists and a group of Minnesota Association of Medical Equipment, so everyone is comfortable with the language that's looked at it. This bill, members, deals with prosthetists and orthotics, looking at the folks that help fit very, very complex and expensive medical equipment for patients that rely very heavily on this equipment. It involves really whether they're whether it's a prosthetic or another piece of equipment is functional to the point where they're able to get out of their home and participate in life. We've heard from patients in the committee and members as they've had visitors trying to pass on information about this bill about the complications that arise when you have a piece of equipment that does not fit appropriately and just how complex of a process that is and the long-term complications, not just physical, but emotional, that can cause when someone feels like instead of cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, $150,000 artificial limb, they have something that doesn't fit appropriately, and so they're stuck with $150,000, might as well be paperweight, because it's too painful to get up, to stand up, to move around, and the long-term damaging effects that can cause folks. With that, if there are questions, I can answer questions, and I know we have some testifiers available if we get too far into it.
And members, just to draw your attention, and I'm sure most of you caught it, but just so we're looking at the right language, there's a committee engrossment that is the most up-to-date language, so just that all the members are looking at the right language.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions for the author? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerwas, I want to ask you kind of the same questions. I'm not very familiar with these folks and these different titles, and, you know, but I guess, first of all, you know, since the statute requires the submission of a written report, was there such a report, and does it address these issues so that there's something that I could look at?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, we did get some submission of information, and that can certainly be provided.
Okay. Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so maybe you could just address then, or maybe your testifier could address these questions that the statute requires before we, thank you, before we vote on this, you know, what the harm to the public is that could be posed by the unregulated practice of the occupation or by continuing at its current degree of regulation, and then any reason why existing civil or criminal laws or procedures are inadequate to prevent or remedy the harm. So in this case, I would guess that, well, first of all, I don't know if there's any kind of regulation already, but I guess I'd like to know, and we're not talking here, I don't think the statute is saying, you know, is there harm from somebody who's practicing badly? Because we all know that even licensed practitioners can sometimes practice badly. And obviously there would be some harm from that. But the real question is, what harm is there if we're not having this highest degree of regulation of these various professions?
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Richard Miller. I'm a Minnesota-educated certified orthotist, and I'm also the president-elect of the American Academy of Orthotists and Prosthetists. Very good questions, Senator Liebling, and I would like to address them in sort of the order of severity. Perhaps the most worst-case scenario would be if somebody was depending on a substandard device that had been provided by someone with not adequate training or an unqualified provider, that it creates because they're depending on either a prosthesis or a device that aids in their mobility. So they're standing on some. These are body braces, would be the kind of the generic language describing orthotics. And that's everything from a full leg brace to a scoliosis brace for the torso to perhaps a some type of a support for the arm, the wrist, the ankle. But for those people that are depending on this for mobility and stability in their ambulation, it could potentially cause a fall, which I guess if you take it to the worst case scenario, could if it was on steps, it could lead to a life-threatening condition. Has there been some documented evidence of that occurring? Not to my knowledge. Perhaps the second category would be more supported by anecdotal evidence, and this is seen in practices across the state of Minnesota and the United States. As far as having solid documentation and evidence of that, I could maybe produce an additional report or a study that that can do a better job than I have time for today. But the supplying of ineffective or substandard care by an orthotist or prosthetist with an unqualified provider would lead to potentially a sore, a pressure sore, again requiring some type of a remedy. This absolutely does happen in qualified provider situations. You can't eliminate all variables in these cases. However, if it's an ineffective device or an inappropriate device, that would then require replacement, and these situations do occur across the state of Minnesota, however undocumented, but anecdotally related. In this category, I believe we do have a testifier here in session that might be able to even reflect a little bit greater on that and give you some insight as to the potential that exists for harm and a sort of a real case scenario. So we can call that person to forward, and Ken might be able to help us understand this a little bit better.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself and then proceed.
Chairman Mack, members of the committee, my name is Ken Rockler. I'm a resident of St. Paul. I have testified here since the late 70s. This is the first time ever I've been here as just a private citizen, in this case a patient. I saw last Friday this on the agenda, and because I've had some personal involvement, as I called up my orthotist and said, you know, I know some of the people there. Is there anything I can do to help you? So I have no dog in the pony as a lobbyist, just as a patient. Quickly, in 2005, I went into a coma for 47 days from MRSA. I came out. I couldn't walk. I then got introduced to people that had to help me with some braces just to learn to walk again. At that point, eventually that same infection ended up with me losing my leg in June of 2007. I started to appreciate then how expert the people in this profession have to be. Just the slightest miscalculation in my case, as I was starting to try and use my prosthetic, if there was just the slightest thing wrong, I ended up having to wait another 2 or 3 weeks, and I was getting good expert advice at the time. It wasn't like I wasn't getting good advice. Then, after I finally got a leg and was able to use it, and everybody did a good job on it, in 2011, I ended up with another situation where I needed to wear an orthotic boot. I got the wrong advice. I'd rather not get into where I got the wrong advice. I know some of you may want to talk to me sometime after this. I sense Representative Liebling has questions like that. But in my case, I ended up losing my right toe. I am 99% sure in my case, if I had gone to somebody that knew what they were doing and a licensed orthotics person, that would not have happened. I'm also aware, because people, when they see me wear a prosthetic, we start talking about it, that there are a lot of people that have other similar stories. I can't name any of them right now, but that's my own personal story. Most of you will end up, either yourself or somebody, needing a prosthetic at some time in your life. Hopefully not, but the statistics seem to be going that way. I think at that point you would want to feel secure in knowing that the people that are fitting you know what they're doing. If anybody has any other questions, I would be glad to answer them. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And really my question, thank you very much for your testimony. And I guess my question would be more to the gentleman from the organization, or to Representative Zerwas. And that would be, you know, from this I understand that, well, I just want to know, so are there people in Minnesota who are doing this work who in fact are not, in your estimation, qualified? And if this bill is passed and there is a licensing regime imposed, that such people will in fact not be able to do the work anymore?
Mr. Miller.
Thank you. Well, the answer to that question may be actually in real time be able to be answered by some of the other 15 states that have enacted licensure for orthotists and prosthetists, including the state of Iowa most recently. And there is currently a master's thesis proposed to study this from mining some of the data that's available in the federal data banks regarding sort of a before and after effect of state licensure and what this has on the potential. As far as identification of unqualified providers in the state of Minnesota, currently there is a very active facility accreditation that's available throughout the United States. I'm an accreditation surveyor as well for one of the national boards. So I literally in that capacity have been in every orthotic and prosthetic facility in the state, and others that range from Fairbanks, Alaska to San Juan, Puerto Rico. I am a resident of Rochester, by the way, so just you don't get the idea, I live in Washington, D.C. yes, I thought it'd be worthwhile to raise that point. But the issue is that as we pursue additional higher education in our field, we recently have gone to a master's level requirement And then that was not done without great deliberation among the professionals in the field. And we've increased our resident requirements for those coming out of those programs. Again, the concern is for the quality of care that's provided. And this is much more than taking a pre-manufactured device from a box and giving instructions and saying, you know, call me if there's problems. These are all single prototypes. Everybody has a different body structure. Everybody comes to us with potentially different disease characteristics. We treat patients in orthotics anyways that range from cerebral palsy, multiple sclerosis, adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, pectus carinatum, and I want to bore you with my knowledge of Greek and Latin, but the point is that we receive referrals that are detailed prescriptions from physicians. Sometimes they're not so detailed, and we have to do a little patch job and resubmit for more detail. But because of the vulnerability of the patient population, the amount of dollars that may be at stake, and these are very valuable resources, both through the state medical assistance program, through CMS and the Medicare program, and through private payers, that we're acutely aware, as prices tend to be driven in a downward direction in today's climate, that there exists potential for additional fraud and abuse, that which is available anecdotally, and that's what we have seen in other states and on a federal level. I guess we're protective of the state of Minnesota. We'd like to be proactive. We'd like to think that we're the best ones to help define who we are and what we do. It's a very specific type of scope of practice. It's kind of hard to define. You go beyond the definition of maybe an amputee. It's kind of obvious when you take a look at an amputee without a prosthetic leg and see what's missing. Well, it's our job to replace that, make it functional, make it safe. And I guess I'm here on behalf of our referred patients that come to us and trust us to do the right thing. And we feel that the establishment of minimum qualifications can help provide professional care at its highest level.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So is there already some system of registration or something like that in Minnesota?
Mr. Miller.
In Minnesota specifically, no. There are national accrediting organizations. There's actually two that are primarily involved with offering credentials for certification of individuals and then offering accreditation programs for facilities. So that they sort of dovetail and act together. But it's not a requirement. Some of the federal language has referred to qualified provider language specifically to orthotics and prosthetics. And this was legislation that was enacted on the federal level in 2001. It's known as BIPA 427. We keep hammering on this on the federal level. But it identifies qualified providers very specifically along the lines of how we've done that in this proposal. It has yet to be enforced. What does happen in licensure states, and this happens today, that as soon as a licensure act for orthotist, prosthetist, and podorthist is enacted in a state, the message goes to CMS, and they then inform their contractors that in order to pay on any type of claim submission, that the caregiver associated with that care must be a licensed practitioner in that state. So it provides some measure of the avoidance of the potential for fraud and abuse. So that, and there has, believe me, 15 years ago, the OIG identified on a national basis, mostly concentrated in the state of Florida, on a huge fraud and abuse scam that cost taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. Did they harm patients? Maybe by pulling those dollars and resources away from the availability. But was there actual direct and real harm? Well, probably not. But we want to be as protective as of the financial resources to provide these as we are, at least if the care gets taken away, then those patients are left with nothing.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think the testifier from Rochester might be able to enlighten a couple points. Does the VA have internal certification, education, and training? And if so, does the VA training, education, and work experience count towards qualifying for the certification activity?
The VA, thank you. The VA has a unique status and responsibility specifically to orthotics and prosthetics. The Veterans Administration personnel who are working in orthotic and prosthetic VA facilities can meet their own standards, their own internal qualifications. And these standards are recognized by our accrediting institutions, so that when I go in to do an accreditation survey on perhaps the Minneapolis VA, the Houston VA, or the San Juan Puerto Rico VA, that we don't necessarily look so hard at whether they've been certified by a national accrediting board. We look at the internal vetting process and training qualification process that they have at that facility to determine those qualifications. So VA acknowledges kind of a unique combination of circumstances to allow them to provide care and to qualify them as care providers. What the Minnesota Orthotic and Prosthetic Licensure Bill does is to allow the board to review those unique circumstances in the case of a veteran who wants to be employed outside the VA system. A VA orthotist and prosthetist is exempt from day-to-day the requirement for licensure under this bill. They fall under the exempted category, as do physical therapists or occupational therapists whose scope of practice already encompasses a certain amount of overlap with some of our services, particularly in some of the orthotic upper extremity, low-temperature thermoplastic devices that the occupational therapists provide, and also in gait training for prosthetic users that physical therapists are routinely. But once a veteran would leave the federal system and seek employment outside, that's where this licensure law, and maybe a unique among licensure laws, we have the ability to consider that on a case-by-case basis and issue them licensure for the benefit of having them go forward and provide services. Thank you for that question.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In, you know, relational, it would be considered a portfolio qualification, and is there a process that is already existing with the you know, the board, the oversight that they would work into, or would this be something that have to be totally created in rules?
Mr. Miller.
Thank you. I believe that this is something that would have to evolve. It is a condition that is anticipated within the law. I think that the additional rule could be specific, more specific than I can be right now, but at least as a general order, it's a possibility within this licensure law. And again, it's not an intention to box anybody out who's currently a qualified provider.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions. The first one is probably less important, but it'll help me ask the second one. I think it's better, it might be a question for Mr. Miller. Is it orthotist or orthotist?
Mr. Miller.
It's correct, it's orthotist.
But then if you're talking about the practice, is that orthotics?
Mr. Miller.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I was when I heard you say orthotist, I got worried just because my son during his first year of life had to wear an orthotic helmet, and I was, you know, it was very impressive watching the orthotist work on it. There, you know, there was a complex 3D imaging on the computer. Yes. like that exact type of thing. Yeah, so people can see. But there was clearly very impressive software involved that was designed specifically for the shape of his head and to just to help correct it. So, you know, I don't know that that speaks necessarily to this bill, but it, you know, I did have relevant experience with an orthotist, and I now know how to say that too. The more serious question is probably better asked towards Representative Zerwas,
yep.
Just as the chair of the licensing subcommittee. But I guess I'm wondering, you know, since we're hearing a few different licensing bills for different areas of practice, I'm just wondering about the need if there is a need for consistency between these bills. I mean, just looking, you know, having looked at the bill before this for genetic counselors, and now this one for orthotists, you know, like looking at Section 11, line 9.10, there's a provision relating to license lapse due to military service. So if somebody's in military service, you know, they don't have to worry about paying late fees and that sort of thing. And that seems like a really good provision to have. And I was wondering if that's something that should be in all of these bills, because I didn't see it in the genetic counselor bill. Similarly, the fees I noticed on the last page, line 12.4, the initial fee to be licensed as an orthotist is $600, but the genetic counselor one is $200. I mean, obviously, those are different fields of practice, but that seemed like a fairly wide variation. And I'm just wondering if, you know, if as chair you see, you know, that these different licensing bills should be treated consistently as far as some of the policy provisions, like the veterans provision and also the fees.
Yep. Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, members. So I'll go backward. The fees should be based on the amount needed to administer the supervision of the licensees. And so that would vary based on the number and the number of licensees and kind of what they're monitoring, what they're managing as far as enrollment. And then the orthotics bill itself with the section for military service, I think we're tending to see a lot of, and Representative Kwan brought up the VA component to the bill. We're dealing with a group of practitioners that specialize and deal with, at some point in some patient cases, amputee or traumatic amputee patients, which is higher incidence of that type of patient coming out of our military service. And so as this group professionally evolves, there's a lot of folks that are specializing in this type of healthcare coming out of training and expertise within our military service. That's kind of a state of the times, I think.
Representative Freiberg.
I see the Mr. Miller has.
Excuse me, Mr. Miller.
So just one more detail. It is a biannual renewal on that, and the fee is a maximum of $600 annually. We're kind of setting the bar high, and we'll adjust that in a downward level. We don't anticipate that we will exceed that, so it's expressed as a $600 maximum fee biannually, with the expectation that those costs are going to be reduced after the initial ramp up.
Okay, question from Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you've answered, but I'm not quite sure. How do all of these guys who just grew up learning from somebody, how do we make, they do just as good a job as the people with master's degrees. How do we make sure that they're not excluded from this?
Mr. Miller.
With regards to sort of the provision that we tend to call the grandfather provision, where there's a phasing in of sort of allowing everybody to come in under a licensure act. This licensure act is very specific as to the level of certification for a practitioner. In other words, requiring national certification by one of the two boards. Within that arena, and currently it's happening again across the United States, and I know firsthand in the state of Minnesota. There's also privileging that occurs. And what privileging, how it's defined in our profession, is that it's someone who doesn't have the exact credential, but is supervised either directly or indirectly, depending upon the complexity of the care that they're providing or the device that they happen to be working with at the time. So, for instance, there's a classification of a technician. Well, a technician really isn't qualified to do an initial patient evaluation or do a care plan or anything like that, or even a final fitting. But perhaps a technician who's been appropriately trained in-house, and again, just, you know, working on the bench, and believe me, I came up through the bench as well, that this person who's trained and has been vetted by their employer, by their organization who they work for, can actually be privileged to provide patient care under direct or indirect supervision with under the rules of having specific written criteria that they have followed to prove their competency. So they've demonstrated proficiency and knowledge in the specific action that they have been privileged to provide. So it's a limited focus. It can also help to we call those care extenders. So, you know, we don't have to run around and perform every little function. If there's a rivet that breaks loose on one of those Velcro straps, a technician can do that and actually deliver it back into the patient room upon that repair. But where it gets a little bit fuzzier is with the other categories of certification. And those scopes of practices are also fairly well described. But again, they can be privileged to go beyond their scope of practice under the provision of privileging and under very specific rules of supervision.
Manager. Representative Mullen.
But some of these, you're talking about working for somebody and a supervisor. Some of them have their own businesses, and they can do a wide range of things very well and better than a lot of people who have all of the academics in the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm not very convinced from what you're saying that they're going to be able to continue.
Mr. Miller.
I would have to know the specifics. I know someone who retired from an organization that I worked with, and he had a hobby farm out by Salem Corners, and he saw his clientele that returned to him, and I believe that he let his certification lapse. He was an individual who came up off the bench, learned on the job, but pursued certification. And at a bare minimum, we feel very strongly that persons that are entrusted to follow physician orders, provide intimate degrees of patient care through patient contact. This is hands-on. We can't make any of this stuff without actually contacting. I asked Rob if he'd be my patient model, but we can forego that. But it really requires from an initial evaluation, if we have to take measurements or three-dimensional models, there are methods now that allow us to do that electronically. But the majority of the types of measurements and things that we need to collect, it involves skin-on-skin contact, get out the tape measure, find the bony landmarks, identify those on a measuring sheet, and then if we need to have a positive model, it would be similar to rolling a plaster bandage on like you see for a fracture treatment. But we take that off and use that as our negative to produce. So that's how all of these devices are made. That's how we initially have contact with the patient. It's pretty in-depth. We feel we've allowed for the majority of people who are qualified to do this work, certified and uncertified.
We have one last person on the list for questions, and the members, we should move ahead. We have one last bill to get to. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I'm just not seeing it, but we've heard testimony about a grandfather clause and that people who have the bachelor's level, who've been practicing for years, would, you know, not be prohibited from continuing. Even, I mean, it's like when we went to PharmD for pharmacists, we didn't, you know, take all the existing pharmacists out of the practice. And I just don't see it in the bill, in the committee engrossment, and if someone could point that out to me, because I just don't see the assurance that current practitioners have a chance to have a different way in. It was clear in the earlier bill that they did, but I do not see in this one, and I also have some concerns about saying it's okay if you're working for the VA to not be licensed, but then not really having a clear route forward. And if anything, I would think the VA would have the highest standards given their obligations to our veterans. And so it seems a little odd on this bill to have exempted the federal government from these regulations. But I still don't see the, quote, grandfather or the way that you can get into it without going through a new program. I see that you can be licensed in another state, but I don't think that would apply to most people.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, we can't require the VA to comply with licensure. Much like the VA police department doesn't need to be post-certified, we can't qualify, or we can't require the feds to do that.
Mr. Miller, to that point?
In Section 3, they are specifically exempted. So under the exceptions, the third bullet point down, individuals who practice orthotics, prosthetics, or podorthosis as part of their employment by the federal government or federal agency. So it's a specific exception to the licensure requirement. And I was referring to a grandfathering clause as an example of how it occurs in other state licensure laws. In this particular law, what it's requiring is certification. And existing certification of these individuals who have been in the field longstanding, it goes back to the era when I was, in fact, certified. And at that time, the requirement was for an associate degree level. Well, I had to go back to school in order to get it at that time. But if a certifee has maintained good standing with those accreditation bodies and have maintained their certification and practice throughout, those are still acknowledged. That I don't have to go back and go through a master's program in order to get my license. As long as I've maintained my national certification during that period of time, in effect, we've eliminated the need for a grandfather clause because we have not independently established those requirements, those education requirements. Those have been established over time by the accrediting boards, and we let them in. If they have a certificate, no matter at what time in history they've achieved that, if they're certified, they're licensed.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I do see the certification. For those of us who are not experts in this field, you have all kinds of accreditation and certification, a lot of different organizations noted here. But I still don't see the path forward for Representative Quam's example, the person who was working for the VA to get in here, or when can people... So are we just adding licensing on top of certification, and certification remains the easier route to care? It's you know, I'm just not clear exactly if we're having a dual-track system of certification and licensure through this bill, and the distinction between the two in terms of their scope of practice.
Mr. Representative Zerwas first, and then Mr. Miller. Representative Zerwas.
So Section 12... certification through endorsement would be how a board would license someone that would be coming out of the VA or something similar.
Mr. Miller, did you want to add to that?
Yes, we're not creating a dual track. What licensure is doing in this instance is to create a requirement for certification. Currently, there is nothing federally or in the state statutes that require that certification. So in other words, there's no requirement to provide this type of care. There's no requirement for recognition of the title orthotist or prosthetist. It literally could be anybody at this point in time.
So, Madam
Representative
Chair,
Loeffler.
Then there are people practicing this right now without certification who will not be eligible. There are people who may be certified right now who can continue practicing, and then there's going to be another stature for people who are licensed. Am I understanding sort of those tiers?
Mr. Miller.
That is most likely a good explanation, not a detailed explanation, but on the surface of it, there will be a category of uncertified and unlicensed individuals, and that falls onto like the technician level, which at the time when this bill was introduced, we were attempting to include technicians in the licensure act. They were exempted.
Well, thank you, Madam
Representative
Chair.
Loeffler.
I think when we find all those people who may fall in the gaps, if we do, I'm just going to refer them to Representative Zerwas.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, members, I'm not seeing any. Excuse me, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess it's maybe a comment. I feel it. Mr. Miller kept talking around Representative Loeffler and my questions over and over, and it just seems that there are those people that are doing an excellent job out there that can't get in under this bill, so I can't vote for a bill that does that.
Okay, members, not seeing any other questions. Representative Zerwas, final word on your bill, and we'll vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill is more about making sure that as we fit and equip equipment that ranges everything from skull caps to leg braces to six-figure in cost artificial limbs, that fit is done with the highest quality and the patient perspective in mind, and we want to make sure that we're doing that across Minnesota with a high standard. And the concern of some people that may be practicing currently that aren't yet certified, there is in the bill under Section 12, there is an endorsement process for someone that is currently working in the field and has been there for years and for whatever reason isn't accredited through one of the boards. The reality is if someone is certified and someone is trained and qualified in this current scheme, they would be eligible for licensure. And we need that in case we have bad actors.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. With that, members, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 2344, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Zerwas, and to the testifiers. Members, the final bill of the day is House File 2322, Representative Peterson. And members, Representative Peterson moves that House File 2322 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. We have the bill in front of us, and Representative Peterson, I understand that you have an A1 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I do have some treats that I'm passing out because you guys have survived a long day.
Thank you very much, Representative Peterson. And so, members, to get the bill in the order that the author would like, we'll take action on the A1 amendment. Representative Peterson moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Representative Peterson, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to give some more clarification, the amendment just removes the Advisory Council, Section 5, and also the effective date of July 1st, 2017. This bill was heard at the hearing on February 23rd and has been fully vetted with the with all the stakeholders. However, I know that you've received some information as well, and I just wanted to point out immediately that I am working with those groups to make sure that this is a very inclusive bill. Part of the reason that we have this bipartisan legislation in front of you is because licensure is required in order for lactation consultant services to be reimbursed by medical assistance, and that is through ACA and then also in private insurance. There are some great disparities in breastfeeding, because, and so the Department of Health has identified populations that need increased support to provide services to populations with the greatest of these disparities. And I think we can all agree that breastfeeding is health is a great option for parents and is helps have healthier children and helps reduce health care costs in the long term. So I guess, in essence, that is the main identifiers of this bill. I do have some people here for backup, but I'm open to questions, and we can go from there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't even have to raise my hand.
You just looked you look ready,
I
Representative.
I just had that
Liebling.
Look on my face. Yes. You know, Representative Peterson, I, first of all, let me say, I am such a big supporter of breastfeeding and breastfeeding education, and I breastfed three kids, and I really, you know, I went to La Leche League when I was in that time of my life, and I've always been a huge supporter of this. But what you just said, and thank you for your honesty about this needing to be licensed so that there can be reimbursement, that is not a reason in my, I mean, I get it. I do get it, you know, that people would like to be paid, and if you pay them for a certain thing, that might increase the likelihood of it happening and so on. But that is something that licensing is not supposed to be for. And so I just, you know, I want to ask you, I mean, you've been honest about that, and thank you for that, because so few people are, and I think that that actually is driving a lot of the people who want to be licensed, mm-hmm. and mostly we don't even talk about it, so mm-hmm. I really do appreciate that. But can you address any of what the statute requires for licensing, namely, what's the harm? And, you know, let me just say, too, I do understand that for some situations, a trained lactation consultant can help where maybe the LHA League wouldn't be able to. I do mm-hmm. get that there are levels of expertise, and sometimes a higher level is needed, but I don't really see where the harm is here that requires licensing to remedy it. And can you fill me in? Does that really exist?
Well, thank
Representative
you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. And, I mean, I'm not a big licensing fan myself, and however, there's bigger issues here, and you have a very small window, as you know, as a mother, of being a successful nursing mother and having the qualified people to help you. And the other thing I want to point out in this bill is it does not hinder anybody from practicing this profession. They don't have to be licensed to continue to provide services. So I think that is one distinction that maybe some of these other bills have. However, if they do want to get compensation from the hospital, or the hospital wants to get compensated for these services that they're providing, this is one pathway to do so. But I think that we can all say that there can be some harm to babies that are not breastfed and they end up being on formula, you know. What and or would like to have some more professional testimony than myself. I certainly have people here to justify that.
Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that's really necessary. Representative Peterson, thank you for that. I mean, the harm we're talking about is not between being not breastfed versus being breastfed, because the question is, what is the harm if we don't license people? And, you know, this is the kind of thing that, you know, we as a state have other ways that we maybe could approach this. You know, if enough of us believe that there's a real value in breastfeeding, which I think we should as a health committee, I mean, I think we probably, a lot of us could agree that this is a mm-hmm. really important issue for a lot of reasons. You know, we could do grants. We could, you know, we could pay with state-only funds if we can't do it through Medicaid. You know, there are a lot of ways that we could do this, but I just feel like licensing is not for this, and licensing is about fencing somebody out. And, you know, I don't know if the bill doesn't even stop people, lower qualified people from doing the service, then I really don't think that, you know, I don't think we should be doing that, but it just doesn't seem to me like licensing is the way to go here. So I really feel, you know, this is the service that I most feel an affinity for of the ones that we've talked about today. You know, I mean, you know, different members have used different services or have family that has and so on. And, you know, I really understand the value of this, but I just don't feel like I can support this because it doesn't do, licensing isn't for this. So thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Peterson, two questions very related to each other. What are the other credentialing entities, and what is the enabling body for the IBLC? It being an international organization, is it just an NGO, or is it an off-branch of the UN? Or I'd like to know where it came from and who the enabling oversight entity would be.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Representative Quam. And I do have someone coming down here that can help answer that question. And I just want to remember that this is also about disparities in health care. When we have large populations on MA and they can't get services because there's no compensation for it in Avenue, it is still something that I think there's going to be harm. So,
welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Mack. My name is Joanne Wesley, and I am an International Board Certified Lactation Consultant, or as we abbreviated, an IBCLC. And my board that certified me is the International Board of Certified Lactation Examiners. And so they provide an examination that allows us to be certified, but you have to meet a number of qualifications before you can be allowed to sit for that exam.
So who is that? Who makes up the IBCLC?
The IBCLE, Board of Examiners, is made up of board of directors that is elected, and they cannot be an employee of the organization IBCLE. So we know that much.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess they're elected by whom? Is there a governmental oversight agency? Is this just an association that got together and formed? That helps me feel a little more comfortable of the entity that's doing the licensing certification.
Right. So it's a certification. It's not a license. And the other part of that is there are a couple of associations that lactation consultants or others with lesser credentialing there can belong to, get their information. So there is the Lactation Consultants Association, and there's also a UCLA, which is a United States Lactation Consultant Association. Those are the two that I'm most aware of.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my assumption is it's a self-regulating entity from the two associations named then.
Correct, and then they thank you, Chairman. They would then put forward the nominations for people to serve on that board, and that it is an international board. People are from all over the world on that board.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And this seems like a typical thing that we run into with licensing. One group got their certification or from one entity and one association, and someone got it from another and someone else from a third, and yet it's only one organization that says ours is the best. And and that's where we're having a hard time here, because I think most of the members of the committee have gotten a variety of emails from people who are certified by another organization that they claim is effective and deserving of also being considered, and it's hard for me to weigh as a layperson why the IBCLC is so much better than the CLN or the CLC, and I don't even know what all the acronyms are. But we're being asked to pick and open the door to MA reimbursement to only one of those routes forward. And some of the information that's been provided to us says that there are twice as many people, and I think this is nation, no, this says it's in Minnesota, that there are twice as many, 7.88 CLCs per 1,000 live births in Minnesota, and only 4.58 IBCLCs per 1,000. So the particular group in front of us is actually the smaller group. Mm-hmm. And by picking this group, we may end up closing the door on a larger group, and I would love to see some geographic information about is that a difference too in terms of, you know, would some parts of the state have access to people who would earn reimbursement because they went through this association, and other parts of the state where they had a better outreach program for the other group wouldn't be able to. And if, you know, Representative Peterson, if you can help us sort through why we should pick this one versus the others, because that's really what this bill asks us to do. Mm-hmm. And it would be helpful, because I really think it should be a benefit that should be available to all mothers with people who are appropriately trained. Maybe there's some people who have extra training, and they should do just the cleft palate babies or ones that have unique problems. But as a lay group, it's hard for me to say this is the one. Versus the others, especially when it's the smaller one.
Ms. Wesley.
Thank you, Chairman Mack. I'd like to address that, because the International Board of Examiners, that is the only board currently providing a certification for the IBCLC credential. There is not another board that provides that. So there are other organizations that provide education that would allow that person to move forward and take that examination. There are other credentials that CLC, it's a lot of alphabet soup, I do have to say, but there is that CLC, and that is significantly less education than the IBCLC. And I actually have a nice chart here that I could hand out that speaks to that and talks about what the education requirements are and who does that certification. So that might really help to take some of the question out of all of that, if we could pass that around.
Yeah.
Everybody,
well, Madam Chair,
that.
Representative Loeffler.
That doesn't really answer the question. She's an advocate for her organization, which has, you know, maybe it does have much more hours and whatever. The question is to me, what is minimally needed in training for someone to effectively support a mother who is facing challenges in this area? And when, then what is their scope of practice? And that's, I think, the trick for me, and I just don't feel like I have enough information to say I know that the CLCs throughout the state should be, you know, sort of not be given the ability to serve our MA moms, particularly if it's a lesser training program. That's probably actually more likely to have people, for example, who speak foreign languages for our immigrant population, or who are, you know, have had, you know, the training that isn't the maximum, but they still could be really effective, and they have met the CLC standards. So I just feel like this one is premature for us to be picking one particular certification and having access to the MA revenue stream.
Ms. Wesley.
Chairman Mack, we don't want to fence anybody out. We recognize that that CLC, the legislative leader, the WIC peer counselor, that all of those are so important and vital to the work that we do across the state without question. But we want to have that IBCLC be that standard that the Surgeon General himself had talked about in 2011, that IBCLCs are the only healthcare professional certified in lactation care, and recommends that all mothers have access to IBCLC services as an essential medical service. And they recommend licensing of IBCLCs as a method of delivering lactation care and services to all mothers. So the CLC, the Little H League Leader, I started as a Little H League Leader, so I totally support having all kinds of different types of education and support. But when complications are big in a lactation situation, you want to rely on an IBCLC who has the maximum amount of training in order to help solve that issue or move that mother forward in her breastfeeding quest. So I think that's the part about that becomes pretty critical for us. And there comes in that harm clause. The harm in not providing licensure at this point can be result in premature weaning of our babies and lots of different health disparities.
Okay, members, Representative.
I'll just point out that the handout says there are four different certifications right now. The question before us is who gets licensure.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And members, I'll go to Representative Franson, and then we have Mulry and Freiberg. And we are at the end of our time, members. We will wrap this up and keep going, but if members could just keep that in mind. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is there any way that the CLCs and the ALCs and the ANLCs can be amended onto this bill?
Representative Peterson.
I personally think so, but I do want to continue to talk to stakeholders here to find out the different things. I'm hearing different things now.
Representative Franson.
Well, I've been contacted by a constituent who's kind of concerned about the language, and and then knowing that there is a misdemeanor for anyone who engages in the practice of clinical lactation, that's in our misdemeanor is concerning, and so I'm just hoping that we can come to some peace in the valley before we, my name is on the bill, but before we move forward. And
Chair Mack, Representative.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you for your comments. I mean, my intent is to make sure that this is available to all people that are certified for this service. And I know that this IBCLC has a higher level of certification, and that's why they have the certification that they have. But to me, I think, you know, we have several more stops before we're done. I think there's some work to be done on that, and I will continue to work with these other stakeholders as well. But and then also, it is not required. You're still able to practice this service. It's just it's not required to have the licensure. But if you say that you have a license and you don't, then it's a misdemeanor. Yeah.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chairman. And I just see still real problems with this. I have no information that this is not one of the many licensing things that is discriminatory to practicing people who are people of color and also to clients of color. And so I'm very worried about that. There's nothing that reassures me even slightly in any of the testimony.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, I'm sorry, I'm getting over a cold, so I'm coughing a lot. I notice, I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this question, but I notice on line 2.8, you know, it talks about clinical lactation services being the clinical application of evidence-based practices for evaluation, and I think it's good that these are evidence-based because I think there's a lot of emotion tied up in this. You know, obviously, breastfeeding is not something I've experienced personally, but you know, it is. I know it can be very difficult for many women, and it's I don't know that it's always perfect for women if they're, you know, I heard a reference to when there are many complications. I think that could include complications related to the baby. Also, if the mother is suffering from postpartum depression, you know, and I heard a reference, you know, to premature weaning. I guess I just want to make sure that this isn't overly directed towards that. You know, if there is a circumstance where a baby has to be fed formula, I don't think that's necessarily the worst thing in the world. And I just wouldn't want any sort of licensing to lead to a situation where women are feeling pressured, because it is a very pressure-filled time in their lives. I don't know if anybody has any comments on that.
Representative Peterson.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, thanks for bringing that up, because in 2.36 it says, or another nationally recognized congressionally agency may qualify for licensure. So it's already basically in there. It's just that the Department of Health was the one who wanted to specifically identify IBCLC, because they knew that they're a high-quality program. So it was more of a guidance thing. So we're going off of what the department was saying more than anything, and but we wanted to keep it more open, so that's why it says, or another nationally recognized credentialing agency.
Okay, Representative Mason, and then members will move to a vote. Representative Mason.
Okay, just a couple of comments. One is, I have three kids. One of them I did have problem with the breastfeeding, but when I'm looking at how much time people are spending on this, I'm absolutely amazed. I mean, that's, so it's, you know, I just don't know that many people that have had that needed that much help. So it's really hard for me to balance this out. This is something that's happened forever, and yet there are so many consultants. It's amazing. So I'm kind of going with Representative Loeffler. I mean, somehow we need to figure out, it needs to be broader than it is, and the fact that people spend this much time on something that happens to me automatically is just amazing. The other thing is, I just want to, maybe as a committee sometime we might have some discussion on what Representative Lively, because I get the feeling that people are doing this to be compensated, so maybe we need to change that part so people are coming to us so that they can be compensated for something that you want people to have help with. So maybe, I don't know how the chair wants to deal with this, but that might be something we put on an agenda. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. And I do think you bring up a good point, and I appreciate Representative Liebling's insight into that. This bill does have a few more stops, and I understand Representative Peterson's intent to not necessarily box anyone out, but I think as we continue to move forward with licensing bills, it is a good idea to keep in mind, you know, what we're trying to accomplish with licensing as we move forward. And so with that, members, appreciate your time today, and Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 2322, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
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 The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Peterson. And members, our next meeting will be tomorrow, same time, same place. With that, this meeting is adjourned.